Hey friends, before we start the show, I want you to know that this fall, Rachel and I are hosting VoxCon, a gathering focused on the art of preaching and teaching. It's happening September 21st through the 22nd in Houston, Texas. It's a chance for pastors and teachers to refine our craft and elevate our skills as we learn from some of the country's top artists and communicators. You can learn more and register now at gotovox.com. That's gotovox.com. If you're a preacher or teacher, you're sharing the most important message in the world, and we want to help you make it simple and make it powerful as you proclaim it. So we'll see you this September in Houston, Texas at VoxCon 2023. Okay, here's today's episode. Welcome to Make It Simple, where we take complicated issues and, with the help of an expert, break them down into ideas we can understand, truths we can apply, and questions worth pondering. I'm Matt Popovitz, and with me is Rachel Ryder. Rachel, so good to be back with you.
Oh, it's good to be here, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, I'm excited because today we get to talk with an old friend of mine. But before we introduce him, Rachel, would you introduce our topic for today?
Yeah. So I have a two-part way to explain it. We are talking about apologetics, but we're really talking about like the role of Christianity in our world today. So like what does Christianity mean in our current climate? So yeah. And we are doing that with your friend, Chad Lakeese.
That's right. Today we are talking about apologetics, and in particular, how to defend the faith in the current world that we find ourselves in, because the world has changed a lot, as we all know. And today we're with Reverend Dr. Chad Lakeese. He is the Regional Director for North America at Lutheran Hour Ministries and is a scholar on the intersection of church and culture. And full disclosure, he's a friend of mine for the last 30 years. I've known him since middle school, and now he's this reverend doctor expert guy in apologetics, philosophy, culture, all these different things. And I'm so glad that we get to have him on the show today. Rachel, what are you looking forward to about our conversation with Chad?
You know, I like apologetics. Like, I like the... Any time I get to think intellectually about things, I really do enjoy like entering into that space. And so I'm interested to see where this conversation goes. I know we're going to talk a lot about like the role of Christianity today and what that looks like today. So I'm interested to hear, as always, from somebody who really knows this stuff, what his view is. And so I'm just excited to talk to him and get his perspective.
Yeah, I'm excited for our audience to get to know Chad because he is such a profoundly insightful person, and he has personal experience in this, I'm hopeful that Chad will go into that in our interview. But Chad was really, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, I think Chad was loved into the Christian faith by a really great church, and I happened to be a part of that community that welcomed Chad in and watched God work in his life. And I think it's a great example of what defending and promoting the Christian faith really should have always looked like, but in particular needs to look like in today's day and age. So I'm just happy that our audience gets to meet my friend, Chad, not just because he's my friend, but because he really is the perfect person to talk about this. So, fantastic. Rachel, what do you say we dive in to our conversation about apologetics with Reverend Dr. Chad Lakeese?
Let's do it.
Chad, welcome to Make It Simple. We're excited to talk with you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really privilege and honor to be here.
Yeah. So I want to start with a question. I don't want to assume that our listeners know or understand what it means when we talk about apologetics. So right off the bat, could you give us a simple definition of that word? What is apologetics?
Sure. Apologetics comes from the old Greek word apologia, which we get apology from. And apologizing is not the same thing as apologetics. So originally that word means simply to defend. And so in the history of Christianity, we try to defend the faith and make it plausible in a variety of ways, either by providing arguments for the rationality of Christianity or trying to give evidence for why Christianity makes sense. But plausibility really is the goal. We want to make Christianity believable And it can take a variety of forms beyond arguments and evidence and things of that sort. But essentially, it's defending the faith or trying to make it make sense to those people who might be outsiders and not really know what we're up to.
And over the years, what are the typical things that Christians who have been real champions of apologetics, what are the types of things that they've tried to defend in order to make the faith more plausible or understandable to people?
Sure. I think they work with the assumption that Christianity is a worldview or a belief system. And so they try to do things that make sense of that belief system by saying, you know, here's how you can understand it rationally. Here's how you can understand it as a coherent and comprehensive worldview. They'll either do that by, you know, making rational arguments using logic and syllogisms like you would do in philosophy, or they try to do it by, you know, marshaling different kinds of evidence to say, here's why we can trust the Bible, or here's why we can believe that Jesus, you know, really was a real person, or other characters in the Bible, for example.
So, Chad, my guess is that some of the questions that people may be asking about the Christian faith have changed in recent years because so much is changing in the culture, and it's not the same world it used to be even, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. Am I right in that assumption that the people who have questions about the Christian faith or concerns with the Christian faith, are they asking a different set of questions? And if so, do apologetics need to shift and change?
Yeah, I would guess that some of the questions that I'm already talking about, you know, is Christianity rational? Does it make sense? Or is there evidence, you know, that helps to support the beliefs of Christians or the claims that they make? I think some people are going to be asking those questions all the time, but I think they have kind of become much more of a minority report. Mm-hmm. I think the questions that people tend to be troubled with now is that when they look at the church and they sort of bring in the background assumptions they have about what the church is, the claims of Jesus Christ, who they believe Christians in the church should be and what they should be like, they're not actually seeing that really reflected from the church. And so it's causing a lot of real internal consternation. So I think what they're doing is holding up something like a moral mirror, and they're not seeing the church actually reflect that morality back to them. Internally in the church, I think we would say, of course not, right? We claim that to be followers of Jesus, one of the reasons we need Jesus as a savior is because we're sinners. So to see us acting like sinners, well, we think that's going to be a normal thing, right? So I'm very happy to own the fact that, you know, I'm a hypocrite. The church is full of hypocrites. But I'm also willing to say, you know, there's always room for one more or a whole bunch more. And, you know, we go to the church because we need Jesus, right? I can't achieve the level of moral goodness that I want on my own. But I think the other thing is, you know, there are these much bigger issues that have really become public in the last three decades. So when they bring up this kind of moral consternation, they're thinking about the fact that they've seen the Catholic Church deal with pedophilia scandals. They're seeing these celebrity pastors and other people that work in the church sort of fall from grace because they've been abusers of power, or they have been, you know, financially inappropriate, mismanaging money and funds from their congregation, or of course they've been involved in their own sexual scandals, whether probably not often with children like the Catholic Church, but, you know, say with the church secretary or some other person in the congregation, or pornography addiction or something of that sort, right? And these have become so big and so public that they're, in a sense, I think, overshadowing and overpowering, because they've got an emotional aspect to them. They're overpowering these other questions that apologetics had usually dealt with.
So you, what I'm hearing you say is like that moral failure that people are seeing in the church. Do you think that's one of the biggest objections non-Christians have or non-believers have to Christianity? Is that moral failure?
I think right now it's kind of in your face. Yeah, it is a primary one. So like many other institutions in American culture, the church has lost a massive amount of social trust. I mean, it's declined drastically in the last couple of decades.
So how do you respond to that?
Yeah. So that's a really difficult thing because one, I would have to say, you know, let's just admit that the church that people expect to see is not the one that they're seeing. All right. That's one thing, right? We've got to admit our failures, own our stuff, own our crap, right? Mm-hmm. Apologize, repent when it's appropriate, especially to those who have been victims. But then, you know, what do you do to sort of turn it around?
Yeah.
And I think that's the really difficult thing because this has happened over a period of generations. For many of these people, it's the only situation they've ever known. I'm of the mind to think that, you know, church hurt is the kind of hurt that runs deep. It's like being betrayed by your own family. So recovering from that is like two-sided, right? You've got to deal with a person who's been in some way traumatized by all of this, you know, caused pain in some way, you know, walk around with a bad taste in their mouth to really, you know, trivialize it. Because not everybody's pain or negative experiences have been the same. But then for the church, you know, like how do faithful ministers, how do faithful Christians move forward? I think it's to try to, you know, recognize what Jesus calls us to be and actually make an effort to do it. But if you'll let me keep going with that for just a little bit longer, I think one of the challenges we've had with that is when we have treated Christianity for so long as merely a belief system, right? A worldview, something that I give intellectual assent to, and that's what apologetics has defended for so long. I think we've then lost the emphasis on a way of being, right? A kind of ethical life, a calling for what it means to be human that gives a certain kind of witness, a public witness, one that generates a different sort of plausibility, a believability, a credibility that arguments and evidence just don't, right? That plausibility and believability, when you see the Christian life lived faithfully and well, that's where you tap into that emotional connection, right? That maybe even the grieving that comes out of what people encounter when they encounter the church, far from its best.
So what I hear you saying, Chad, is that perhaps defending the faith kind of shifts away from defending particular doctrines or the particular kind of trustworthiness of this or that or the other thing. Not that those things aren't important, but there becomes an emphasis now on living out the faith in such a way that that an unbelieving world takes notice, that unbelieving world is intrigued, an unbelieving world is seeing clearly that you have a hope or a belief that is shaping your life in such a way that I can't help but notice it and be intrigued by it. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, I think, you know, a good faithful living witness is compelling. The early church has believed this ever since, you know, the scriptures. First Peter writes exactly about this, right? Live a life in such a way that's going to be a witness before the people who are outsiders. Paul writes about it in Colossians similarly. And then, you know, the early church was able to build on that. There have been a number of studies in recent years that really talk about and focus on it was the living witness, even the patience of Christians within the culture in which they're persecuted, you know, the first 3 centuries roughly prior to Emperor Constantine. And they grew because the movement was compelling on the basis of how they saw people, how outsiders saw people living. You know, so this is where we get, you know, classic quotes within Christianity from people like Tertullian, who said, "See how they love one another," or the classic letter to Diognetus, where, you know, Christians share their board but not their marriage bed, right? They care for their children and don't sort of leave them to the elements or sacrifice them. You know, there's this comparison. And so it had to do with very much the social reputation of Christians in that day. And a lot of historians count the growth of the church as being based on this social reputation. They exhibited a winsomeness, a compelling way of life. And it made people sit up and say, "What's different about them? I want some of that."
So Chad, you know, tell me, what do you think is getting in the way of the church today living that kind of a witness? Why do our lives? This is speaking broadly, and it's a huge broad brush generalization. I get that, but why is it that for so many people, their life as a Christian looks so similar to the life of all of their, you know, unbelieving or skeptical friends? Why is it so hard for us to live that life that is winsome and is noticeably different?
Oh, man, that's a really hard and complicated question on a podcast that's about making it simple. So I'll try to make it simple. One of the ways that we could talk about it is that we live in a very pluralistic environment. And simply by that, I just mean we live in an environment of manyness, right? There's a whole bunch of different ways to live, a whole bunch of different views, but even more, a whole bunch of things that are competing for our attention, and they all want our allegiance, mm-hmm. right? And so even in our time, you can see things that we might consider trivial having almost pseudo religious aspects, like being a fan of some sports team, right? It does a lot of the same things that we observe amongst religious people, right? We gather together, we have our rituals, we've got our chants, right? Maybe we even have our songs and our anthems and so on. Or we can talk about nationalism, which is a big deal now, right? With white Christian nationalism. But I mean, dial it down from there, we can just talk about, you know, basic patriotism and so on. Or we could talk about brand allegiance, right? To things like Apple or Google or things of that sort. They all kind of can be analyzed from within a religious frame of reference, or at least using religious language. So that's one reason why I think we're not living out the Christian life and we look like everybody else. It's simply because Christians, like everybody else, are immersed in an environment where we're all being influenced by these things that are competing for our attention, and not just our attention, but our devotion, mm-hmm. right? And so we start to mimic what we see. Many of these things have their own habits and practices that, you know, if we get caught up in them, it engenders in us a certain way of being that makes us look kind of like everybody else. I mean, I own a whole bunch of Apple products. Probably many of you do too. Many listeners do. Or, you know, you think that the Apple buyer is, you know, anathema, and you're completely sold out to Windows, Microsoft, or completely sold out to something else. But just that idea, right, of being sold out to something else, I think takes on a bit of a religious aspect, right? It's a kind of devotion in a basic way.
Yeah, we've had this, you know, we've kind of talked about this before, where we're actually a very religious society. It's just like where our religion, you know, we are devoted to things. We get very passionate about things. A lot of those things that you often associate with, you know, spirituality or Christianity, it's just, you know, Apple, or it's a sports team. So if we back out a little bit more, then if we're trying to be really practical, what do you say that? So what is a Christian? How do we actually practically live our lives in a way that that makes us stand out and makes it intriguing? You know what I mean? Like, if society looks around and they see devotion everywhere, what makes our devotion to Jesus different then?
Yeah, I think the devotion of Christianity is one that takes us from being aimed inward and constantly being told, fulfill your own desires, right? Meet your own needs. Your wants are all good. And you should aim to, you know, achieve all of those to your highest level of satisfaction. Instead, Christianity especially calls us out of ourselves. Mm-hmm. In a way, that is a classic way of understanding traditional religion, that it tends to call us out of ourselves, and to challenge our own sort of internal bent, right? Luther would follow St. Augustine by saying that, you know, the heart is curved inwards on itself. Mm-hmm. And so humans sort of live that out. And religion is trying to call us to a different direction. How does it do that? Well, by the preaching and the teaching of the message of the scriptures, right? Encountering Jesus, the Holy Spirit works faith, generates a new life in us, and empowers us to live differently. But then the church has all kinds of practical ways of doing this, right? So through gathering together at least once a week, but presumably the church would gather more often, the more you are immersed in spaces with other people who are living a certain way, the more the behaviors and the tendencies and the predispositions that would characterize what I think we think of, and even outsiders would think of what they think of faithful Christian, the more those are engendered in us, because we're just immersed in the right kind of environment that's creating in us the right kind of devotion. It's really fascinating that God has chosen to use something that we think is so mundane and common everywhere, to use it in his church to actually engender in his people who live like Jesus. Hmm.
My question is really this. Is there anything that the culture is longing for, that the Christian faith, when lived out, lived out faithfully, lived out with devotion for Jesus and love of neighbor, is ready to give to the culture?
Yeah, I think one thing would be hope. The world around us, I think for many people, feels really hopeless. So not only are we living in an epidemic of loneliness, but there's increased suicidal ideation amongst a lot of people. What contributes to that? A whole bunch of things. And the church is caught up into many of those things, but we have, I think, within our heritage, within our teachings, within the truth of the scriptures, something like the funding for a different way of life. So let me contrast the two. So if we're going to think of the problem of culture at large as being something filled with hopelessness, loneliness, even a certain sense of, you know, I don't want to be here anymore, you know, leading to suicidal ideation, that comes from a lot of things. Right now, our culture is super polarized. We're fracturing and splintering, you know, all the more each day. Every time you think you have a group that kind of represents the truth, the right ideas on the side of righteousness, even within that group, there's a fracturing and a splintering and another new purity cult that arises, and sort of they try to start ferreting out those who don't quite match. And that's just constantly breaking society down. And social media contributes hugely to this. But in other ways, there are other researchers that talk about the fact that social media is causing societal breakdown, this depression, this anxiety, suicidal ideation, because we constantly are comparing our lives to the lives of others. And in social spaces like social media, we generally present the best versions of ourselves, all filtered and prettied up. And we make our lives look amazing and interesting. It's almost a social imperative to do so, right? Go back to the Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting man in the world. Those commercials aren't about beer. Beer is the secondary, you know, piece of actually the higher goal, be interesting, right? David Foster Wallace, you know, he's an atheist writer, postmodern writer, who in fact did take his own life. You know, he talked about being watchable as one of the highest imperatives of our time. And when we compare ourselves to those people that we think are interesting or watchable, our lives don't measure up in some way. And so we feel left out or unworthy. And then that contributes to loneliness, depression, separating oneself from everybody else, maybe even suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. So that's just a couple of examples. What does the church offer then to contrast that? I think we offer a sense of belonging to a much bigger story than sort of me being responsible for my own life, the task of being interesting, for example, or the task of being on the right side of history, right? Being a part of the right group, whether that's, you know, social justice or being woke, or frankly, like, I love David Zoll in his book, Seculosity, when he talks about, you know, I'm not thin enough, I'm not successful enough, I'm not rich enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not woke enough, I'm not enough of enough, right? He uses this idea of being enough. And I think the church pushes back really well against that message in saying, you know, you don't have to be enough. Jesus has already become enough for you.
That's right.
He has done enough to sort of save you, right? All of these efforts to be whatever you think the social image is of rightness or worthiness or successfulness or beauty, whatever it might be, right? All of those are sort of false idols that we're chasing after, and we're never going to be enough because it's entirely on us, this responsibility. But in the church, it's this whole alternative community that actually sort of lets go and has become freed from that calling by the truth of the gospel that says you don't have to do anything. It's already all been done. All you have to do is kind of be, trust that, embrace that truth. And it that's not an easy thing, right? It's about sort of coming together on the regular and hearing that over and over and over and over. And we'll have to until our dying day, because the sort of turned inward on itself part of us is always going to be pushing back. It's always going to be rising up, you know. Our confessions in the Lutheran Church say that the old Adam, the old flesh, clings on. And it, you know, this is 500 years old, this way of speaking, but it's true. Yeah. It's true, right? This wisdom from the past still has a place today. And maybe the church is this space that is open to listening to some of this old, old wisdom, this old, old story that might still actually be helpful today, despite the fact that the church that you see or that we see on the regular is not always living up to its own claims, is not always exhibiting its own kind of the integrity that we would expect from it, right? We can explain some of that lack of integrity internally. We're all sinners. This is why we come to church. I've already said that. But, you know, in that coming together, you should be able to also see a living effort of trying to follow this Jesus as he calls us forward into a different kind of life.
Hmm. Chad, so how do you teach this? I mean, if the old way of doing apologetics, if I can call it that, was about, you know, teaching people about the trustworthiness of the scriptures or the historicity of Jesus, and we taught people that they can trust the fact that Jesus really lived and died and rose, and that the scriptures really are a reliable historic witness to the work of God in this world. How do you teach or equip people for this new apologetic of trying to live out this hope in a way that gets the attention of and is intriguing to the world? Is it really just about the church being faithful in preaching that message to itself and instilling people with that hope? Or is there something else that the church can be doing or parents can be doing at home to try and instill this way of living out and by living it out, defending faith in Jesus?
Yeah, I think you're getting right to the point of apologetics for our time should be something more like a living witness that's compelling. Yeah. Right, it's going to be, in a sense, the best argument for the truth of the claims, because people won't simply see us paying lip service to something; they'll actually see us. You know, people will see that we take what we say seriously because it's reflected in our lives. So, how does the church do this? Yeah, I mean, to talk about preaching, I definitely think that's one way. Right, we claim that the word has power. Right. When it goes out, it never returns empty. I might not always know and see how that's happening, right? It's almost as if sometimes as a preacher, I've got to trust that between my mouth and the hearer's ears, the Holy Spirit is at work in the air doing something with that word. Exposure to it, right? We can talk about basic devotional practices, prayer, reading the scriptures, listening to devotions, reading Christian books. There's all kinds of different ways of being a devoted person. You could do that within your family. You can do that within small groups of Christians. Of course, we do that on the regular every Sunday in Christian worship services. In the home, even further, right? What are some of your habits? How do you sort of take an audit, I guess, of the devotion of your household, right? One way might be, are you showing up to Christian worship every Sunday, right? Is this a regular part of your family practice? Because especially if you have kids, that is a living witness for them. You know, that when you show up there every Sunday, that tells them in a way that as they grow up, this is a part of the dynamic and the ritual and the regularity and the routine of their lives. It ought to be, because connecting with this group of people is one of the most important things to us, right? That's the devotion. But I see a lot of families saying, you know, what's more important is that in the end, for me and my family, my kids have the best sort of resume to be able to apply for college applications. And so that means I'm going to have Jimmy in, you know, competitive soccer, and that's going to take us away from Sunday worship and the community of God's faithful. And then the next season, it's going to have to be competitive basketball, and the next season is going to be competitive baseball. All right. Yeah. So they're always gone. We see them regularly, but that tells Jimmy something.
Yeah.
It tells him how much this Christianity and this following Jesus really matters. Right. So we can make claims with our mouth that this is really important, Jimmy. Believing in Jesus is really important. We want you to be a Christian for your whole life. But when you live in a way that doesn't actually reflect that, Jimmy's going to pick up so much more so on the behavior, the way of being, than the words expressed.
That's right.
And this is what Christians, this is what people outside of the church are experiencing about Christians at large. So one place to do it for sure, like you said, is in the household. Will we be perfect at it? No. But are there ways to do it better? Yeah, I think there always are, right? There are always ways for us to grow.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I'm picking up in this conversation that I think I wasn't expecting was this like really gentle, kind call for people to like, yeah, we need to get back to church and the importance of being in a place of worship. And I was thinking of it, you know, the way you're talking in the context of my own, you know, spiritual walk, but then for our families and for those around us. And I'm just impacted by that, especially coming out of the last few years. It just seems like church has been kind of a yada yada, like, yeah, be a Christian, it's how you live your life, but maybe you go to church, maybe you don't. But what I'm sitting with is really this idea of like, no, there's a really good reason for us to be gathering for worship every day or every week on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to that difference of, do you think of Christianity as merely a belief system, right? Something that you give intellectual assent to, or is it a way of life, right? And the things that we really believe, that we really care about, that we're really devoted to, of course, they're connected to us in some sort of intellectual assent way, but they bear fruit, right? They generate a certain way of living. And so, you know, the philosopher James K. A. Smith, in a number of his books, Desiring the Kingdom, You Are What You Love, he tries to make this argument, right? That, shoot, I could just be an anthropologist. I don't have to be a religious scholar. I don't have to be anybody. I can watch your life and I will tell you what matters most, right? I'll be able to simply see it by how you live. That's what I'm talking about in terms of, you know, thinking about Jimmy and not having the family at worship, but having us at the soccer and the basketball and the baseball games. People will see that sort of lived out. And so that's why we can't really treat Christianity and being a Christian as something that's merely a set of beliefs that we mentally assent to. We have to treat it as something much more substantial than that. They ought to have consequences. If they're that important, they ought to have consequences. And the consequences are, what does my life look like? What do people see reflected in me? And so it is a gentle invitation to come back to church, because it matters who you hang out with, because that's going to determine who you are and who you're going to be and the way that you and your kids live. It's really similar to learning a language. If you want to get fluent, you might as well go move to that cultural space where that language is the only one that you can work within, because it's really the only way you're going to develop fluency. Otherwise, you're just going to study grammar and vocabulary and syntax, and you'll be able to do things like maybe write it on a very basic level, quite formally, or read it as a something like a translator, but you're never really going to be able to learn how to interact with other people who talk that way. You need to immerse yourself in that environment. To be a follower of Jesus, you've got to immerse yourself in an environment of people who follow Jesus.
Chad, if I may, knowing you like I do, I know that this has personal impact in your life because you became a Christian later in life than many who maybe were baptized as a young child. And I know that part of your story is you came to faith as a young adult, and you weren't argued into the faith based on traditional apologetics, even though that became a place of expertise and passion for you later on. You were really, from my viewpoint, having been a part of that process because we know each other for so long. Mm-hmm. My guess is you were loved into the faith by the community of the church trying to live out their faith. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, let's go back. Like, how long have we known each other? What stories do you want to tell about one another? It's been since junior high.
Yeah.
For sure. It was, and you stood up in my wedding. So right. Full disclosure, we've known each other for a long time.
That's right.
You got to see this happen to me, as a bit of an outsider looking in. So I grew up in a nominally Christian household. You know, we were Roman Catholic, but really in name only. We didn't have what I would think of as sort of the normal or regular Christian practices in the household that did the sort of thing that I've been talking about, you know, really forms faith in a person. Or for me, I often try to say it this way, it didn't make faith sticky, such that as I grew into independence, I would kind of carry on and live out that faith. What I was going to end up doing was, you know, live exactly the way that I had been brought up to live, right? To follow in the footsteps and the pathways of what was exhibited to me as the most important. So by the time I got to, you know, eighth grade or so, my parents had considered it important enough to catechize my sister and brother and I all the way through. So we were in the confirmation system in the Roman Catholic Church, similar as many other churches, even within Protestantism in America. But by then, you know, you kind of reach this age and a lot of churches treat you as, well, you're an adult now and you have to own this for yourself. And so I did, right? I kind of took that right on and said, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. And for me, there was no loss because there wasn't really anything that had stuck, you know, nothing sticky. So for all of the rest of high school, then I called myself an atheist, and I enacted my own rebellion by discovering in freshman biology class the theory of evolution, and simply thought, well, this just makes more sense of the world that I experience. It was practical, you know, it just had great explanatory power, and the Christianity that I had learned wasn't very comprehensive and didn't speak to that anyway. What I really knew at about 13 was, this is a ticket out, right? So it was a little bit of a rebellion for me, but I was an atheist then for all of high school. Didn't really believe, wasn't interested in religion, wasn't militantly like anti-religion in the way that some people think about atheism. But all along the way, since I was a little kid, I've been playing drums. My dad had a little kiddie drum set in the basement. I was in a great school system that really emphasized both arts and athletics. And so because I wasn't a great athlete, I dove into the arts. I started playing drums as soon as I could in about fourth grade, and got into everything I possibly could all the way on up. So high school for me was just full of music and opportunities. And I played, every kind of music you could imagine, as a percussionist and in every kind of venue you could imagine, from like the crappiest dive bar that would allow under 18s in, where I thought me and my drum set were going to fall through the stage, to like, you know, state marching band competitions where we were in NFL football stadiums. I mean, everything in between there. It was just so fun. It was really the first great love of my life. So by the end of high school, you know, I'm in a band. Matt and I are doing some music together, and we rehearsed actually in his garage. And his mom had heard me play as a drummer. She happened to be the local Lutheran Church praise band leader, and they took a risk on me. She said, "Hey, you know, we don't have a drummer in our church. Do you want to play?" And I was like, wait. You know, I'm an atheist, right? Well, yeah, we know. And so I had to think about it for a minute. I'm like, you know what? I'll do it if you pay me. And it became a gig. And so I started playing there for about 6 months, and they knew that I was not a believer. And they really didn't do any of the things that I was really afraid of when I kind of imagined what it would be like to encounter Christians who want to convert you. I thought they were going to try to shove Jesus down my throat or beat me over the head with the Bible, because there's often inappropriate assumption that atheists, because they don't believe in any sort of grounding for morality, therefore have no morality. But, you know, my parents still raised me to be a pretty decent person. And I was living that out. But what I encountered when I started at this church was two things. One that I can't explain. And that is, having played drums and music of all different kinds for so many years prior, when I played in church, I felt like I had more fun and I played better than in any other space I ever played in. And I couldn't really explain that. And then another thing that I can explain now, sort of retrospectively, is I encountered a whole bunch of Christians who were just really glad that I was there, encouraged me, welcomed me, loved me, as Matt talked about. And that sort of genuine Christian hospitality left a mark. So for me as an outsider, I was thinking, you know, if I'm going to believe in God, I want him to be tangible to me, right? I want him to do something that I can observe or hear or feel or experience, you know, write it on the wall or speak audibly, "Hello, Chad," you know, repent and believe or something like that. And that didn't happen. So instead, after about 6 months of playing in a worship service and hanging out with these Christians and having this different experience of what it was like to play drums, you know, it wasn't quite enough to like prove it to me and totally convince me, but it was enough to get me to like a tipping point. And so in the middle of my freshman year of college, I went to bed one night and just said, "God, I still don't know if you're real, but I'll give you a chance." And that changed everything about my life. So yeah, then I dove into reading apologetics in the traditional sense, right? The rational argumentation, the sort of marshaling of evidence to make Christianity plausible and believable. And what that was for me, and the way that I look at that kind of apologetics now, is a really helpful way for processing through my conversion, where I had to sort of adopt an entirely different worldview. So I think of it like Neo in The Matrix, right? When he gets pulled out of the Matrix and Morpheus takes him back into the Matrix to sort of reveal these two competing realities. And it wasn't so drastic for me as it was for him, right? Because he got so sort of viscerally upset that you know, he went and sort of threw up, right, in the ship that they were kind of cruising around with in the real world, because this worldview difference was so drastic and so sudden for him. But for me, I had to go through something like that to really kind of make the adjustment. And that's one of the ways that apologetics in the traditional sense functioned for me. But it was this maybe earlier church kind of apologetics that brought about the conversion. Right? My experience of Christian hospitality, the love for them, the fact that they acted like followers for Jesus, I knew they were praying for me. And I came to learn so much more about how they were really trying to lean into me and invest in me and all that time. And to be honest, I'm a complete anomaly in terms of the sociological data. And that's what makes me interested in this, right? All the data says I should be exactly where, most people who were raised in my environment are, right? And that is outside of the church, without a care in the world, really about religion or much to do with Jesus. But God's able to do what God's able to do. And he brought about conversion in me, worked faith in me by the power of the Spirit. And, you know, within 6 months, I felt the call to go to the seminary and be a pastor, which is just crazy talk compared to the life that I lived prior and what I had imagined for my future then. But even more, like, I wasn't sure being a traditional pastor was the right path for me. So I stayed and I did even more studies and was eventually called to be a professor of theology at one of our church's universities. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm teaching religion. And I was in Portland, Oregon. So I'm teaching to an environment of a whole bunch of people who had very similar stories or backgrounds like I did. Right. And so all I was trying to do in my classrooms then was be this living witness that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Right. A what you see is what you get sort of person. I am who I am in the front of the classroom, as I would be preaching from a pulpit, as I would be leading school chapel, as I would be hanging out at their basketball game, as I would be in my kitchen when I invite you over to have dinner with my family. Right. Mm-hmm. You're always kind of going to see and meet the same sort of person. I'm not going to be kind of putting on airs or doing something different in those moments when I claim that I'm a Christian or on Sunday when I go to church. What you see is what you get. And I think that's what I see in Jesus. You know, what you see is what you get. And really, we get this faithful guy who doesn't let any of our issues prevent a relationship with him. And it is constantly calling us to something better that he's already made possible for us and created us for.
Chad, thank you so much. Like, you sharing that is certainly a case for like why like we're called to live differently. It's just really a beautiful story. If somebody's interested in apologetics and they're like, man, this sounds really cool, or that's like that's how I am. I'm like, oh man, like the philosophy of it all, the thinking of it, what resources would you point someone towards?
Oh man, that's a hard question to answer, because I don't know a lot of resources that actually kind of make the argument that I make.
Well, this is why you're writing a book, right, Chad?
Sort of.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Sort of. This should be a resource out there.
There should be. It kind of is one of the reasons that I am writing a book, because I'm trying to talk about things like hospitality in our really polarized mm-hmm. age, where we're not willing to engage with anybody who seems too strange or too different mm-hmm. or too other.
Yeah.
Maybe because we're worried about, like, you know, being contaminated by them or something. But I just don't see that in Jesus, for example, right? Mm, he went to all of those people, right? He was incarnated and born into human flesh so that he could be around sinners of all different kinds. And so rather than sort of avoiding them, I think, you know, the key to holiness is actually a going out to them. Or, you know, how do we sort of regenerate social trust? How do I generate trust in myself and interact with people with whom I have very different opinions and views, you know, whether it's on politics or ethics or something, you know? And we're very divided in our culture in this way. And so I'm trying to write a chapter that sort of leads people through this journey. First of all, understanding, you know, well, why do we sort of disassociate or feel the impulse to disassociate as soon as I find somebody who doesn't believe or share some of my most critical convictions? But then kind of give them some resources subtly from the Christian tradition for how to think differently. One of them is simply like embrace intellectual humility, right? You don't know everything about everything. Maybe there's something to learn from this person that you disagree with. So, you know, listen in order to understand and ask questions rather than just to respond and react. I mean, I think we treat listening, a really critical tool for what it means to be human and have relationships with people, as, you know, listening is just waiting my turn to talk often. And so trying to practice differently how we interact on a human level with people, funny enough, ends up being evangelistic in a way, mm-hmm. right? It introduces people to Jesus because they can see in us a way of being that is Jesus-like.
That's right.
Right. When we try to listen or we try to be more hospitable. Yeah. So yeah, those are some of the more practical chapters that I'm trying to write.
That's wonderful. Well, Chad, throughout this conversation, you know, I've picked up on a couple strings, and as we come to a close here, I wanted to just make sure that what I'm holding on to resonates with you as the guy who's sat in as the expert on this topic for us today. Kind of what I'm hearing, if I had to paint a picture of the new apologetic, what it means to defend and reflect the faith to a increasingly secular and skeptical world, a couple things come to mind from our conversation today. I would say that the new apologetic is one of humility. It is one of hope. It is one of hospitality. And it is a life of different devotion, where you are devoted to different things. And if you embrace those things, I'm not saying that's a comprehensive list, but if you embrace as a flowing out of the message of Jesus, if you embrace humility and hope and hospitality, and you express some kind of different devotion than what everybody else is devoted to, I have to imagine, and I certainly anticipate that someone's going to ask a question about why you are the person that you are. Does that ring true for you, Chad?
Yeah, totally. So let me just go to 1 Peter. And is it cool if I bring scripture into this podcast?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think, it's sort of said the best there. And what I want to get at here actually contrasts with the traditional sense of apologetics. So, for example, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, is regularly quoted as kind of the call to be an apologist. So it reads like this. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. But here's the important part that's always quoted. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. So that's often quoted as a be ready to have the kind of intellectual argumentation or the marshaling of evidence to convince someone, to persuade someone, to prove that Christianity is true, right? But listen to this in the context of actually the whole passage when Peter says this. He says, who's going to do harm if you are eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you're blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord, right? So that's the devotion. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. It is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ died for sins once and for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. This longer chunk of the passage, I think, helps us understand the short one that's always sort of given. It's yanked out of context and kind of used as a what we would call in Christianity a proof text, right? Yeah. But it really just bolsters the argument for their endeavor, right? What they love to do is make rational argumentation or marshal evidence and try to prove Christianity is true. Okay, but back up a step, and why should anybody care about that?
That's right.
Right? Why is anybody even asking those questions, right? Well, maybe it's because, as Peter kind of gets at in this larger section, but really the whole book, it's because somebody has encountered this community of people who are living a totally different way than what they see in the rest of the world. And there's something compelling and attractive about that, right? So nobody's going to ask me questions so that I can answer them if I'm not living as a question first, right? And I think that's what Christians have the potential to do, right? We can be the question in a way through our lives. And then, as appropriate, answer with things like, well, this is what convinces me intellectually about Christianity, to the extent that we're able to answer those questions, or here's evidence and so on, you know, of if this is really real and really happened in the world, well, of course we should be able to see reflections of it in history. Right. But those aren't the reasons that I or anyone believe. Right. We believe because the Holy Spirit's generated faith, and that faith produces the kind of fruit that Paul talks about or the humility that Peter talks about here. Right. Of living in a way that is faithful to Jesus despite the challenges of living that way in our society.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to chat with you and just catch up with you. Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. It was really great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Rachel, I'm thinking that that conversation about apologetics was not what you expected, was it?
You know, it wasn't. When we thought we're going to talk about apologetics and we're going to get into this, I thought it was going to be more of the, you know, is Christianity rational or why does God allow pain? Yeah. And there's that slant on apologetics. And I thought maybe it was going to go that way. But I really liked that we, and there's a place for that. There's a place for that intellectual. That'd be great. But I really liked that it was more like a look at Christianity and what does it mean to be a Christian. And I just really liked that the way that conversation went. How about you?
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's one of the many reasons why I think Chad was such a great guest to talk about this, you know, because as Chad articulated, and you already noted, you know, there is a place for that kind of traditional understanding of apologetics, where we make a defense of the Christian faith. We defend the trustworthiness of the Christian scriptures, the historic reliability of Jesus, right? Did he really live? Did he really die and rise? And all these things, or even some of those philosophical questions, right? Like the problem of pain. There's a place for all those things. But Chad really helped us remember that what the world needs now is what the Christian faith has always been best equipped to give, which is a living witness, a personal witness to the hope that we have in Jesus that changes the way in which we go about our daily lives and shows people that we have a different devotion, we have a different set of hopes. We are a people of humility and compassion and joy and generosity. And let that, as it's lived out in our day-to-day lives, draw people to us, but ultimately draw them to Jesus. That's what the Christian church has always been best equipped to offer as a defense of the Christian faith. And it just so happens that as our world becomes increasingly secularized and skeptical, that's what the world needs most. Rachel, what else stood out to you?
You know, I wasn't expecting it to be a conversation about like why we should go to church. And that came up, I think, in the current culture and like I was saying, the past few years, I think a lot of people have been holding church as an institution up and they're like, man, there's a lot that's wrong here. There's a lot messed up. And people, faithful, believing people have asked, like, do I need church? Like, I hang out with people that love Jesus. Do I need church? And I really appreciated the call back to like, yes, there's a good reason to worship on a regular basis. There's a good reason to gather and to be in that place. And I really appreciated his perspective on that. Like I noted it in the episode, but it was just kind and like a gentle call back to the place of church. And I really liked that. I don't know. That hit me.
No, I appreciated that as well. Not just because I'm a pastor and I love to see people come to church, but
you need people there. Yeah.
But I think, you know, it was tied to Chad's really great point that, really this all comes down to devotion. We, no matter whether you're listening and you're a follower of Jesus or not, we're all people of devotion. We're devoted to different things. Our hearts are attached to certain things. And then because our hearts are attached to all these different things that we love, we do certain things. And the things that we do tied to the things that we love, that's our devotion. And so you really can look at the things we do and go, well, I can tell what Matt loves based on what he does. Apart from what he says, I can tell what Matt loves based on what he does. And Chad just made the point. He gave us the reminder that, look, the rest of the world is looking at the devotion of Christian people. And one of the things that they should see that's different from the lives that they live is that we gather around God's gifts and we go to hear God's word and we gather to sing praise to Jesus. That's part of our devotion tied to the fact that we love him. And if we love him, and we believe that he makes a measurable difference in our lives, to say the least, shouldn't we gather to worship him and then be with his people? It makes sense. It was a logical, gentle reminder because, and again, it's important because so much of what the rest of the world is looking at is looking at Christian people and saying, well, is there dissonance or a disconnect? You say X, Y, and Z matters, but you don't live a life that looks any different from mine. And I know what matters most to me. That's why I do what I do. So why doesn't your life look different than mine? And there should be certain ways in which the life of a follower of Jesus looks different based on the hope they say they have from the life that everybody else is living.
No, I was going to say, I think I also, you know, so there's that aspect of going to church, but I'm left with another just question of what you were saying. Like, so how does my, because I am loved and I love Jesus, how does that, in my day-to-day life, how does that look different? And and maybe that's my make it simple. It's really that takeaway of how he talked about, how did he put it? Looking at your habits of devotion.
He talked about kind of doing an audit of your devotion.
And I think that's where I'm kind of sitting, is like an audit of my devotion is like, how does this look? How does this live out in my own personal life? And then how do the people around me see that played out? Mm-hmm. So I think that's where I'm really sitting is that, you know, he said nobody's ever argued into the faith. And I really do agree with that mm-hmm. we'll be known by how we love. And so mm-hmm. I'm going to ponder on that a little, sit with that.
So, yeah, it's a great question. I want to kind of double click on what you said. I think it's a fantastic question. I think it's one that really all of our listeners, if you're here as a follower of Jesus, should wrestle with. How does my love for Jesus make itself known in my life in such a way that it makes a noticeable difference in my life and other people can see it? If I say I love Jesus, how is that expressed in devotion to Jesus in my life in a way that my neighbor can take note? Now, I get it that we could take that to like a really legalistic place and, you know, but we don't want to do that. But I think it's just as an exercise, I think it's a really helpful question. For me, my make it simple, I think was really stated at the end of our conversation with Chad, you know, as I tried to summarize all the insights he gave to us. I think my make it simple is this. I think modern apologetics is a life of love. It's people of faith living out humility and hospitality and hope and expressing a different devotion than the rest of the world. And I think if we're able to embrace those things, a life of humility, hospitality, and hope, and a devotion to Jesus, all under the banner of love, then we will have a life that is intriguing to others, and people will ask questions. And my prayer is that God's Spirit would fill us and prepare us to answer those questions when they come. Mm-hmm. That's my takeaway.
There you go.
Well, Rachel, if our listeners have thoughts on this episode, we encourage them to head over to Instagram and look for the post related to today's episode and drop a comment or a question on that post. You can find us over at Instagram at M-P-O-P-O-V-I-T-S. We would love to know what you thought about today's episode with Chad Lakeys. All right, Rachel, this was good one. What do you say we do it again? Shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
you sound skeptical.
We should. We should keep going.
Okay, good. Whew, yeah. Man, I got nervous for a second there. Okay, good. All right. Well, definitely then we'll be back this again sometime soon.
Thanks for helping us make it simple. The show is produced by MPM. Our editor is Marcia Lambeth. Artwork for the show was designed by Brenton Little. Do you have a topic you'd like us to tackle or an expert you'd like us to chat with? Send your ideas to info@mattpopovitz.com. That's info@mattpovitz.com. And if you'd like more information about Make It Simple or MPM, just head to mattpopovitz.com.